Rate. Debate.
Okay, it's recording. Good.
I'm recording.
I'm recording. Okay.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, girls and kids.
That was a Silky Ganache reference to all you Drag Race fans.
Good one. welcome to Frame Debate Recreate. I'm Sammy Purcell.
And I'm Logan Keller.
We're back for episode 13. Can you believe it?
Unlucky 13. About 13 the musical.
Yes, that's all we're talking about today.
Featuring Ariana Grande.
Here she is, ladies and gentlemen. Just kidding, I would actually lose my mind. But I do have a question for you, Logan.
Yes, Sammy.
It's kind of personal.
Okay.
But have you ever seen something that wasn't there?
Yes, frequently.
Okay, frequently.
I mean, maybe not there in this dimension.
Okay. I used to, like, have lucid dreams. Or is that what it's called? What's it called when you, like, can't move? Sleep paralysis. When I was little, I had sleep paralysis.
Oh, very different.
Yeah, sorry. Very different. But I don't think I've ever really told anyone about that. Because I had, like, vivid dreams where I would see, like, little green men surrounding my bed. Maybe I was abducted by aliens. Who knows?
Perhaps.
But anyway.
Well, Sammy, have you ever seen things that aren't there?
Other than that sleep paralysis experience, I have not, at least not to the extent that we're going to talk about today. So do you want to go ahead, give a little explanation about what we're doing here today, Logan? What is this?
Yes, so on Rate, Debate, Recreate, every week, Sammy and I will discuss two shows. We'll rate them out of 10, debate the merits of each show, and try and figure out which one's better. And at the end, we'll recreate a part of it to also make the show better our way, because we are most certainly the experts.
Of course. We are the experts. We know what's best. So as we said, each week we have a category, and this week that category is shows where the protagonist sees things that aren't there. We're getting very creative with these titles.
I mean, our second one was literally shows about high-profile trials regarding murderous women.
You know, sometimes
they've been pretty,
you need to
pretty
pick
out
a
there.
Specific category.
To yeah, really for
put
real.
These together. Anyway, my show is none other than Sunday in the Park with George.
And my show is Next to Normal.
Excellent. All right. So I guess we can jump into those summaries.
Yeah.
Started.
Let's
I go
do it.
Or should you go?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So Sunday, the famous, beautiful, amazing, prolific Sunday in the Park with George. I really love this show. Is a show by Stephen Sondheim, music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, based around a fictionalized version of George. How do you say his last name? Surratt?
Surat?
I don't speak French.
Surat.
I feel
like it's Surat. Surat.
I'm going to say
Chua.
George. Okay. I'm so sorry. I am not very cultured. Anyway, so a fictionalized version of that artist, George. And it's based on the painting A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of, again, La Grande Jatte? J-A-T-T-E. Help
something
me out.
French.
Something French that I cannot pronounce. French is hard, okay? You don't say anything like it looks. I'm very jealous of anyone who can speak it really well. Anyway, so it's based off that painting, and the main character is a fictionalized version of the artist, George, who is in a relationship with his model, Dot. Because he paints with dots. Anyway, George is a famous painter, but sort of struggling, so he's very experimental. He's painting with specks. These little dot to try to create larger pictures, and the art world is kind of making fun of him for it. But he's trying to kind of break into that world a little more heavily. So he's very obsessed with his work, and put simply, it gets in the way of his relationship with Dot. So she eventually leaves him and starts courting Louis the Baker. And she very obviously misses George, but Louis loves her and respects her in a way that George frankly can't. Fast forward a bit, Dot is pregnant, and it's revealed the child is George's, but she and Louis are going to leave for America. She tells him that. There's a big, beautiful song, big blow up. And that is sort of the end of Act 1. Then there's Act 2, which, like, we can discuss later on. It skips 100 years into the present. So you have George's great-grandson, I believe, who's played by the same actor in most productions, all productions, who's a contemporary artist who's giving a presentation about George's, old George's, work and reflecting, and kind of like reflecting it in his new modern work. So he's with his grandmother, Marie, who is old George and Dot's daughter. And Dot only told Marie towards the very end of Dot's life that George, the painter, was her father. And present George is very skeptical of the facts. Like, he's kind of like, oh, I don't know, like, da 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 da. And he still struggles with the same issues that old George did. Sorry, it's very hard. They have the same name. So he kind of struggles with connection and art, as one does. And after Marie dies, he travels to Paris, and he has this sort of meeting in his head, a la The Category, with Dot's ghost, a vision of sorts. And he kind of confronts his feeling of adriftness, and she tells him to stop questioning his choices and to move on. Yeah. So I'm going to give, which this show that I love very deeply, I'm going to give it 9 out of 10. Mandy Patinkin ruffs.
When I was rewatching the show, I literally was like, this part's so weird.
He is so good, though.
It's amazing.
So good. I'll talk about him later. And the only reason it's not getting 10 out of 10 is because, and I'll talk about this later too, part of me, I go back and forth on the existence of a second act at all, but I'm not Stephen Sondheim, and maybe this show is about questioning him, but whatever. So that's the only reason it doesn't get 10, because I'm not always certain about how I feel. But yeah.
Toupee. Awesome. Thank you for that. So Next to Normal, where to start? So Next to Normal is a rock musical, and the book and lyrics are by Brian Yorkey, and the music is Tom Kitt, who you may know from If Then, at Idina Menzel, SpongeBob, SquarePants, the musical, which I saw twice on Broadway and absolutely loved. And Jagged Little Pill, the Alanis Morissette jukebox musical. Also, fun fact, Next to Normal was actually originally, it was just a 10-minute piece that the two of them wrote for a final project together, and it was called Feeling Electric. And then in the off-Broadway production, Feeling Electric was the closer of Act One, but it was eventually cut. And the song that, like, it wasn't a direct replacement because this is the beginning of Act Two, but the song that replaced it is Wish I Were Here. Anyways, as that's an aside, Next to Normal tells the story of a family, and it centers on the mother who struggles with bipolar disorder along with other mental illnesses. One interesting thing about the show is that it only has 6 people. So I decided to just give the description of each that appears in the playbill. I don't have the playbill. I've never seen this live, unfortunately, but, this is like what they say about each. And then I'm just going to talk a little bit about each person. So Diana, a suburban mother, sharp, delusional, bipolar, depressive, 30s or 40s. So Diana is the mother, the matriarch of the family. You don't really know actually until a little bit into the show that she does struggle with bipolar depressive and also delusions. And so at the beginning, you kind of just think she's like this suburban, like almost like soccer mom kind of vibe. Like she's like that fun mom. In the first song, she's like, I'm gonna go have sex with your father, to their daughter. And she's really like snarky with her son. But then you come to realize, spoiler alert, the son is not alive and has not been alive for 16 years. So he is like part of her delusions. And I think he's like literally a physical representation of her mental illness on the stage. So his description, Gabe, Diana's son who died as a baby. He comes back to her in visions as a teenager, like as in Gabe as a teenager. So in his visions, especially at the beginning of the show, you think that they're like this family with a son and a daughter and they're all like, oh, lovable and stuff. And it really takes a quick turn from there. So Gabe is entirely not like all his interactions in the show are with Diana, and they're all like literally delusions that she's having of her son. So yeah, that's Gabe. Dan is Diana's husband, handsome, genuine, constant, tired.
Tired.
30s or 40s, tired. I can relate to that
Same.
one. So yeah, he is this character who is really struggling to figure out how best to be there for his wife. It's really tragic
Yeah.
because he wants so badly to help and to like fix, for lack of a better word, or to like try
Yeah.
and improve the situation, and ultimately he just has to accept that he can't. So yeah, that's a really like tragic character. He like is he might have some like rough moments, but for the most part he's a really, really loyal, like good person, and just tries to do what's best for his wife. Next we have Natalie, that Diana's daughter, 16 and trying to be perfect. It's not going well.
Can relate. Wow,
Yeah,
who among
so
us?
she's pretty much that, 16, trying to be perfect. She's like a pianist and does a lot of classical piano, and applies early to Yale and is admitted early. So that's kind of like her vibe, but the story that we see of her in this show is her kind of starting to parallel her mom's journey with mental illness. Although Natalie's fear feels a bit more like self-aware because she's so aware of it being because of her mother and because of all that situation. So, yep. Then we have Henry, musician, romantic, stoner, slacker, philosopher king, 17.
Literally, I have such a big 16-year-old crush on Henry. I can't. I love him.
Yeah, I love Henry. Henry is Natalie's love interest in the show. He is exactly as described: romantic, stoner, slacker, philosopher king. He kind of like is a really a source of like sanity, I would say, for Natalie, who doesn't feel like she experiences that in her own home. And yeah, they have a really cute relationship. I think Henry is a really nice guy. He like introduces her to weed and like I also think is genuinely helpful for her in discovering her own self, in the journey that she's going on. And then finally we have Dr. Madden, slash Dr. Fine. There's like one actor that plays both of them. On the young side of ageless, assured a
Wow.
rock star. Yeah, so this is just the two doctors that treat Diana over the course of the show. Dr. Fine, I think the no, it's Dr. Madden, I believe, is the like bigger character who's there for most of the show. And they go through different types of therapy. They try hypnosis, they do ECT eventually, which is electric. And yeah. So I'm gonna rate Next to Normal yet again, second week in a row, 10 out of 10. The rating system is a quote from Diana. So this is 10 out of 10. People who think they're happy are just stupids.
Wow. Awesome. Okay, I think I'm gonna rate Next to Normal. I'm gonna give it again a 9 out of 10. People who think they're
Beautiful.
happy are just stupids.
And I'm gonna give Sunday in the Park with George 8.5 Mandy Patinkin ruffs.
You and me, pal. Let's go. Oh man, I love him so much. Oh, I'll probably say that a million times during this whole thing, just talking about how much I love Mandy Patinkin. All right, should we get started in some discussion stuff?
Yeah, I think we should. I can get started with a few like big picture thoughts I have
I
about
love
Next to
that.
Normal. I just have to say off the bat, this is one of my all-time favorite musicals. I really, really love this show. This is a sh I Sammy and I both were like, before this, like I think we might cry in this podcast episode. And
Literally.
honestly, it might happen. This show, like, is I think one of the most genius, but also like heart-wrenching in a way where you just empathize like so much with every character in the show. It does that so well. So a few of my big picture things about this show that I love, first is the depiction of mental illness. So I guess first things first, I should clarify, I do struggle from mental illness, but also I'm not like a professional by any means, so I'm not trying to speak on behalf of like what is the best representation or not, but as someone that does struggle with both depressive disorder and anxiety, this show hits so fucking close to home in so many ways. And I personally think it does a really beautiful job of showing that on stage and showing it in a way that is, I think, like pretty real. Obviously, this is a like more extreme example, but to me, I'm kind of thinking of this akin to in the Fun Home episode where we said like telling stories to represent marginalized folks. So in this case, people who struggle with mental illnesses, instead of trying to tell like one broad, a broad one size fits all story that like kind of hits at all these different points, like telling a real individual human story in a really compelling way, even if it's not like representative. Again, Diana in the show is obviously not like that's, she's a very, very severe case. To the point now where like at the time this they did diagnose it correctly in the show, but since then the psychology has updated, so now they would describe it as psychosis what Diana has. Like that's a very unique experience, but they just narrow in on that and go all in on her and her relationship with the family, and they treat all the characters in a really human way. So I really, really love that about the show. Another thing I want to talk about is a hero's journey. So I am such a hero's journey nerd. It was literally cracked into my skull by my high school English teacher, Mr. Story. If you're out there listening,
What a name for an English
yeah,
teacher, first of
yes, we
all.
love Mr. Story.
Wow.
Anyway. He was huge on the hero's journey and applying it to not only the protagonist that we saw, but also kind of like to ourselves and our lives. And this show does this, but in a really, really different way than I think it's done in most forms of media that like especially follow the hero's journey. For those of you that are unfamiliar, the hero's journey is basically like a cyclical pattern that like you'd be surprised, like literally everything in the world like follows it, which is basically like the story of growing as a human. But also because of that, like what we see represented a lot in movies and theater shows and books. Theater shows.
Theater shows.
And it basically starts with the hero. They go down into the underground, and like usually that's when they're at their lowest low. And the whole idea of it is that like when you're at your lowest is also when you're most capable to grow. And so then they're like triumphant and they grow, come out of the underground. Both Diana and Natalie have like the hero's journey, I think, in this. And I actually, this theory, not the hero's journey theory, but some of the things I'm going to talk about, I read in this like in unbelievable analysis of Next to Normal by, I think, Scott Miller. Yeah, Scott Miller. I cannot recommend that everyone look it up because it's can't recommend that enough because it's
Do not look
so,
it
yeah, don't.
up.
Anyway, so some of the I ideas I'm like pulling from there, but they both go on the hero's journey. Diana like literally goes into the underworld like of herself, of her own consciousness at different times in the show. Like in Catch Me I'm Falling slash Make Up Your Mind, she is delving into herself, and like he as her therapist is literally like trying to get her to go to the moment of trauma that started this, which in this case was the death of her child. And that is, I don't know, it's so crazy, but the song literally describes it as her like walking down this flight of stairs into a dark, dark hall and like needing to dive deep to like go back to this moment because she has just like, as a defense mechanism, literally one of the lines in that song is the visions are just your defense. And it's this defense and kind of like representative of how unbelievable the body can be in response to trauma. Because that's what it is at the end of the day. So anyway, back to the hero's journey. Natalie also goes through it, but like I was saying, she's self-aware of it because she's like seeing everything with her mother, and that fear is causing her to literally start to take the same path, not because it was like her destiny or what she was bound to be, but because she's like fearing that so much and putting that so much in the front of her mind. But ultimately, she has this awareness that I think Diana doesn't get until the very, very end of the show. And I think also Henry is really helpful in her like maintaining her sense of self and confidence. But yeah, one thing that I think is especially good about the hero's journey portrayal in this show is I feel like we often end in the hero's journey in one of two ways in like most forms of media. One is they're successful, they're triumphant, and like it's a happy ending. The other is they're not. So, you know, we have like
Yeah,
Shrek and
of course,
on one hand and
Shrek.
Into the Woods on the other, you
Yes, of
know,
course.
like,
Well, Into the
but
Woods is like hopeful.
yeah,
Yeah.
actually, that's not a good
Yeah.
comparison because I think it's actually similar to what I'm about to say.
Game of Thrones, bad.
yeah, there we go. because at the end, it's like just ambiguous. There's not,
Yeah.
it's not a necessarily a failure, but it's definitely not a triumph. But in a way, to me, it feels like one of the most realistic and relatable portrayals because the hero's journey, it doesn't end in the same way that it does. It's this one's like realistic, it's cyclical. There's no like real happy endings in life, as
Yeah.
we learned in Into the Woods.
And Shrek.
There's always, and Shrek, there's always going to be something next, like
Yeah.
another chapter. And the point of it all is that it always is going to be a journey to find the light. And that's they end on like needing to find the light in the darkness.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think just like as a rock musical, as a musical that delves into like self-healing and not always self-healing and different forms of therapy and medication, I think the show is such a like great depiction of the hero's journey and also mental illness.
Yeah, I want to touch on like a couple things you said. One, to agree, and one to like maybe account for a little bit of why I took the point off.
Yeah.
But it's not even really a bad thing. It's just like something I question and like maybe should talk out. So I thought like talking about like we did with Fun Home about how like making these stories like super specific and like trying to like focus in on like very real emotions and somehow. If you focus on those specific emotions, like it's somehow more, you know, meaningful than it would be if you made generalizations. And it's so interesting. I think this show achieves that. But I was like looking up kind of like what people thought about the representation of bipolar disorder specifically in the show, because of course, like those like that language and like how we talk about it has evolved since then. It's been a while, you know. And so there's a quote from Brian Yorkey, where he said that he and composer Tom Kitt, they were trying to create this musical, like when they were going about it, in which bipolar disorder could be replaced with like a number of topics like alcoholism or drug abuse or any other sort of mental illness, like, and the themes of the play would still stand. And I think that's like so, and it's a credit to them because I think like that idea, like having that in your head, could lead to a generalization, but I still think they're able to be super specific about like what Diana is going through and what that family is going through. But I still think like the way, you know, like a mental illness can affect a family and like effectively like tear a family apart or bring it together, you can still replace, obviously the story wouldn't be the same, but you can still like replace it with like alcoholism or a drug addiction. Like I think they succeeded, but still were able to keep it pretty specific. And I think that's really like
I
incredible.
totally agree.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like a big part of that is like the musical is not like about, it's not a bipolar like musical. It's about like going into your trauma. And
Yeah.
that is like at the core a lot of what mental illness and different forms of addiction all are. I think they're just different manifestations of that.
Yeah. No, I just thought that was like a really interesting quote, and also like it's
Yeah,
crazy
I
to
really
me
like
that they
that.
like achieved that, because I feel like that's really hard to do. And then this is the one thing, so I think like this show has like Sixth Sense vibes, or if you don't know that Gabe is dead, when it happens you're like holy fucking shit, like you like literally like
Yeah,
your jaw
freeze.
drops and you freeze and you're like holy fuck. And I think they do a pretty good job at like maintaining the illusion, because he's like always around the family, right? But if you know and you watch like Natalie and Dan, they don't react to him when he talks.
Mm-hmm.
And only Diana does. But like, if you didn't know, you wouldn't really notice it. But I wonder, and maybe like you have thoughts on this, what do you think is like the broader implication of Dan seeing Gabe at the end? Because I have always like, wait, what the hell? That's my phone. Sorry.
It's okay.
Me. Okay. Sorry. I don't know. Someone from Seattle is calling me. I'm not available. But like, because I think that's a really, it's like an incredibly touching moment. Like it's very, it like makes me sob every single time.
Yeah, me too.
But when I sit there and think about it, like, because he then like he talks to the doctor and is like, can I talk to someone? So is that like a manifestation of like,
I have a big take on that.
And is that like, is he seeing a different Gabe than like Diana's seeing? Or I've always,
yeah, so my take on that is that I think that light is a massive, massive theme of this show, and it has a lot of different like implications and layers. And I think that Diana is like terrified of the light.
Mm-hmm.
That like, that is the, and I think that also parallels with the like electricity.
Yeah.
As like a, she like views all of, and you can see like throughout the first act, she, all the things that are like considered the light in the show, the biggest one is Gabe.
Mm.
And I think that like he represents that and is that manifestation of her again, like going into her trauma. And at the end we see Dan go there for the first time once Diana leaves him. Like he hasn't been, I don't know, I think he's like had this persona that he, because he didn't develop, you know, a really the same reaction that Diana mm. had, that maybe he was like over it. But to me, it shows that, I don't know, mental illness, I really firmly believe is a spectrum. I don't mm. think that like some people are just inherently mentally ill and some people aren't. I think that we all carry different forms of that in us and they come out as we like experience trauma in the world. And I think that that moment at the end is him going there.
Yeah.
And like for the first, that's the first time in the entire show that he says Gabe's, that he says his
I
name.
Know.
It makes me yeah.
Every single time.
Oh, yeah. So that's my take.
No, that's really beautiful. I like that a lot. I guess like I was, when I was watching it like this time around, I was trying to be like, trying to watch it and be like, okay, like, does it make sense that like, just being like very logical, like, does it make sense that Gabe is doing this thing and like no one else can see him, but she can see him, like six sensing it in my head, like literally. And that was one time where I was like, is this a, because I would assume it's like a different version of him then, right? Like it's, and Aaron Tveit, like to his credit, he like really plays the fucking shit out of that role. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I think like, it's so strange because with Diana, he is like weirdly tender and it's almost, it's like disconcerting and it should
yeah.
be. And then with, like you would watch him with Natalie and he's like, a fucking dick. Like he's so like he is like so older brother that it hurts. Like very like Superboy and the Invisible Girl. He stands beside her and like glitters behind her and the smirk on his face is absolutely just like so it made me like actually cringe being a younger
yeah.
sibling who has very accomplished older siblings. I was like, oh god. But like, and then with Dan, he is like tender, but not as like sexually charged. It's a very like strange.
Yeah. So yeah, my take like, is he's the manifestation of Diana's like,
sure,
of her like internally. That's how she feels about Natalie and Dan. Like mm-hmm. she kind of feels like a resentment towards her daughter. And I think that like is what Gabe is doing to Natalie. And like she like has respect and love for Dan, but clearly there's not like the chemistry and it's, he's not like her savior necessarily.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of the way that Gabe treats Dan in the show too.
Oh, I just, yeah, that's really great. I just remember like watching Aaron Tveit is kind of, I was like,
ugh, yeah. Whew, unbelievable
buddy. Buddy.
Okay, I could talk about Next Normal forever, but I feel like we should hand it over to
Well,
you for Sunday.
speaking of acting, I'm gonna start crying.
Oh my God, me
I
too.
literally, I can't get through this show. The first act of the show in particular. The second act has like really, really standout moments, but the entirety of the first act, I just feel like someone has like stuck their hand into my chest and is like twisting my heart around. Oh my God. So I just want to talk about Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters for a minute. Just a minute. So I know they're actors. Like, this is their fucking job. Like, I get it. And like, I don't want to like praise people for doing their fucking job, but I also do because
Yeah.
I am always so incredibly moved by these two performance separately and especially them together, and I've spent like the last week trying to figure out like what exactly they're doing that makes me like twist my insides up in a knot. Because watching them, they're both very emotional, but like they don't necessarily, and like Bernadette, like during like Color and Light, like she does like the dancing thing, the girl at the Follies, like da da da. But like neither one of them in this show are necessarily like super Broadway, you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
they're not
Like
like really emotive in a really
they are,
exaggerated
but they're
way.
not exactly.
Yeah,
Like they're not exaggerated, and obvious. So like you can rent this the Broadway version of this on Amazon. I don't know if you can watch
It's
it here
also on
for free.
YouTube.
It's on YouTube. Yeah.
The
So
actual Broadway, not a
yes,
bootleg.
like an actual thing. So you can watch it, and I don't know if it's like maybe I've never seen it live, so maybe it's just like that they're up on their faces, but it was like heavily lauded, so I have to imagine that like what they were doing played to the back of the room, you know? But like I've been trying to figure out like what the fuck they're doing that makes me just like twist up into a little ball of emotion. And I think like part of it is there's like a lot of longing and yearning, and like that's very sexy. So like that I completely gravitate towards that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But also like I am a sucker for when like people obviously love each other, but just like not in the way that the other person needs. And it's like I just find it like the most heartbreaking. It's maybe like the most heartbreaking thing that can happen to a couple on screen, I think, is when like there's obviously so much love, but it's either not even that the timing's not right, but just like the other person doesn't need what
It,
you're putting forth
yeah.
at the time. And like that sucks.
Those two truths can coexist.
Yeah, and I'm just a fucking sucker for it every time.
Me
And there are
too.
like I want to talk about like a couple of songs, like in particular, a lot of We Do Not Belong Together, but I'll start with Finishing the Hat because I have like a little less to say about that.
Oh.
But oh God, Finishing the Hat. But
Unbelievable.
it is, I think it is like so hard to just stand there, and this is why I really respect like Broadway actors. I think it is so hard to just stand there and sing a song with nobody to play off of. And both of them, Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters, and anyone who does this show, this is, I'm just talking about that performance. Anyone who does this show has to do that pretty often
Yeah.
in this show.
And like in a really literal way with Dot especially. Yeah, she's
Yeah.
like modeling
She's
and
just
like
standing there. And of course, like, I mean, Mandy Patinkin is there, but he's just sitting there, and every once in a while he'll be like, lift the chin. But it is just, I think one of the hardest things you can do is just like stand there, nobody to play off, and sing for 2 minutes. Hard and act.
Yeah.
And I could say this about a lot of shows we cover, but like to you have to make them interesting. You have to like run the gamut of emotions, especially in this show. You have to run the gamut of like every emotion that exists. And to do that while you're alone on stage with no one to play off of is like very fucking hard. And these two actors, without being like over exaggerated, are really fucking amazing at it. So,
Yeah.
Finishing the Hat, first of all,
And
horribly.
neither got a Tony.
That's who did? I didn't even look it up. Who did? I like
I don't,
assumed.
not either of them. I'm mad.
Okay. Fuck that. Anyway, let's move on. So, congrats to whoever got that, Tony. I don't mean to them. But, Finishing the Hat, first of all, just like incredibly sad song. Just like completely resigned to the fact that he'll probably be alone forever. Sad. And a lot of it's the lyrics too, right? And the music and everything about it. It just all like coalesces to this perfection. And I love how he says, like, when he's talking about, like, looking at Dot and looking at art, he says, like, leave a little space in the way, like a window. Like, he's, like, on the outside looking in, or, you know, like,
waving not through a window.
Exactly up there. And I think it's, he's waving through a window. Of course. God, wow. Another lyrical genius moment. I think, like, he says, but to see, it's the only way to see. And I love how that describes an artist's viewpoint. Like, artists are on the outside looking in, right? Like, they're describing a scene. But it is also, like, how he looks at Dot and, like, kind of portrays this, like, horrid, like, fear of getting too close to somebody and not being able to look at them like he looks at the world, right? Because that is how he views the world as an artist. And, like, being scared to get too close to someone and let it disappear. And it always gets me, and, like, when the music swells and he goes into that last chorus, I just, like, I'm about to cry right now. I burst into tears every time. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And then, like, specifically to his acting, it, like, amazes me. And she does, Bernadette Peters does this as well, how quickly he can go from, like, absolute warmth and, like, love in his eyes. Like, looking, like, when he says, yes, she looks for me. Good. He is, like, looking off to the side, and he looks so in love. And then in a second, it changes to tell me why she left me, as I always knew she would. And there is, like, so much pain, like, all of a sudden, like, shooting through. And he just has this, and she has it too, but this, like, ability to turn on a dime. And it's so big and small at the same time. Like, I don't know how to describe it. But going on to talk a little bit more about Bernadette, because, like, my love, my life, Bernadette Peters. And We Do Not Belong Together, which is the scene where she comes to tell George, she's pregnant, she comes to tell George, I'm leaving for America. And he's like, you're not going to like it, blah, blah, blah. And they have this big blowout, and they sing We Do Not Belong Together, which, if you haven't listened to that and you're listening to this, like, I don't know what to say, but go listen to it. And Bernadette Peters, again, like, the way she moves from, like, hurt to, like, pure, like, bite. And, like, I mean, Sondheim has some, like, teeth, right? Like, he's, like, pretty sad. He can be pretty savage. But, like, the way she moves from, like, hurt and trying to control it. Like, she starts off so controlled and she says, yes, George, run to your work. Hide behind your painting. And you can tell she's trying not to cry. But she's, like, so, like, tight in her face. And then when she moves on to, I thought she might care to know, like, that I'm leaving, foolish of me, blah, blah, blah. She slides into this, like, petty meanness and this, like, sarcastic, like, just, like, biting smile. And she does it, I don't know, I just, like, you can't see the gears working at all. Like, she just does it. And they both do that. And I think it's just, like, the whole exchange is just incredible to watch from, like, a facial standpoint. Just, like, the way they slide into each emotion is incredible. I can't, and I don't know, I'm sure it must have played because people like this musical and they couldn't watch it on TV. And I'm, like, watching their faces like, wow, they have the best faces in the world. Jesus Christ. Like, I think the acting in this is incredible.
I wholeheartedly agree. I actually have a hot take. This is my favorite Sondheim musical. By a lot, honestly.
I think I fluctuate a little bit with Company sometimes, which, like, fucking hot take, I guess. They're two popular musicals, but, like,
that might be my favorite music, but I think that, I don't know, I love this show.
That's a good, I just, like, can't watch the first act specifically. There are moments in the second act that do the same thing, but the second act is, like, a little more, like, there's, like, how's putting it together.
It's weird, yeah.
Like, yeah, and not that there aren't, like, fun moments in the first act, but, like, the entirety of the first act, I just, like, feel like something is twisting my heart into a fucking, like, ball.
Yeah. I think that also Sunday in the Park with George has, at least that production of it, has some of the absolutely most insane staging of any show ever. It's like the stage is the painting, and it progresses as George progresses on the painting until the end of the first act, when all of the characters take their places and it is the finished product. It's like bone
And that,
chilling. Ugh.
I do like how that continues into like the second act, like when he's doing putting it together and he's like running across the stage and he'll like pop up different versions of himself to continue doing his like schmoozing talk. Like I really like the staging, and it did, so it won Tony's. I did look this up. I forgot. I don't know
It
why I
was
said that. I did
Lekaj
look this
that
up.
won.
But it didn't it win it won Tony's for like scenic design, like design stuff, right? I'm pretty sure. Because it was nominated for a
Yeah,
bunch.
it won scenic design and light. It won like all the design, I think, ones.
Color and light, of course. But yeah, I just, you're right. It looks incredible. I love the like little gag with like the fake soldier. It's like carrying that guy around. So like there's a real soldier and then he has like a cardboard cutout that he carries around of his friend. It's pretty funny. And then like, I don't know about you, but watching it back and like this is I think this is obvious, but I was like really struck by it because I looked up some of the history of this show. So it came up right after Merrily We Roll Along, which was like a failure, like all around, critically, commercially, just like a failure. I think it ran for like 16, 15, 16 performances, like just did not do well. And Sondheim apparently was like, "I am quitting musicals. I'm done." Very dramatic, but like I
Wonder
understand.
what his sign is. I'm gonna look that up.
Look it up. But James Lapine, who wrote the book, persuaded him. I hope I pronounce that's how you pronounce his name, right? James Lapine.
Yeah, Lapine.
Okay, great. So he wrote the book and he's like, let's go look at this fucking painting. I think it's at like in at the art museum in like Chicago. And he persuaded him to like write another musical based off of this painting. And when you're watching it, like there's so much, like it just feels extremely personal, especially like knowing that background. Like it did before, but knowing that background, like there's all these quotes like artists are bizarre, fixed, cold. And then when they're like judging George's art piece, the two like the husband and wife characters who are like the art who are in the art world and are like a little more like respected or whatever. They're like, it's just density without intensity. Which is like a very Sondheim descriptor for someone who doesn't like him. And they're all mind, no heart, like very intellectual, like none of the feel. You know what I mean? Like it's very much like so how someone would describe Sondheim if they didn't like him. And like laughing at his like experimental tactics. Like I hear he's trying to paint with specs. Ha 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 ha. And then at some point George says like I don't paint for your approval, which is it's very much like a at the same time that it's like beautiful and like and gorgeous like meditation on like what it means to like make art and like have connections with people. It's like also very much kind of a fuck you to like everyone, which I appreciate a little pettiness. I love it. So yeah.
I actually think that one thing these two shows have in common that I think Next to Normal followed in Sondheim's footsteps on is like following the Sondheim rule, content dictates form. I think that the music in both of these shows, like in very different ways, really are like intertwined so deeply with the content. In the case of Next to Normal, like the music literally like is bipolar in the sense that it experiences high highs and like manic states. There are really low lows. There are also songs that cover both of those, like I Miss the Mountains. And then in Sunday in the Park with George, like the dot oh I love the like dotting songs that oh yeah.
Oh,
And
I
there are so
know.
many times too in Sunday, like every song is this, but it's like the songs are not just songs, they are the like
I know.
everything.
Like they are the everything. And that's what makes like when we get to Bopus, I'm kind of like, okay, well like there's not a ton of like bops in like Sunday in the Park, you know what I mean? Like, but when you watch it, like it all
That's how I,
thematically
yeah, like
makes
I don't
sense.
really
You know, like,
listen to it that much. I listen to Sunday a lot.
I listen
That's on
to
my workout playlist.
Sunday. I listen to Finishing the Hat a lot. It's just
Really?
sometimes you just need a good cry.
Yeah, I agree. Very often I do, actually.
More often than not, I'll just like pull up that YouTube video of Mandy Patinkin singing it and be like, oh God. Beautiful.
Yeah.
These shows are both very beautiful. Wow.
I agree. Okay, I just have a couple things I need to say about Next to Normal.
Okay.
The first is that this is a big clarifier for me. I think that in the first episode, I may have jokingly implied that Sutton Foster deserved the Tony over Alice Ripley. And I just want to emphatically say that that was a joke.
I was right.
And that Alice Ripley gives the performance of a lifetime in this show and 100 trillion% deserved the Tony.
Yeah, she's fucking incredible. She's so good. Yeah.
It was very important for me to say that. Also, I just want to say that there are so many songs in this show that are like, I'd listen to a lot, but also just hit me on such deep, deep levels that it's really hard to pick a favorite. But if I were to say three, the whole show is a bop list. That's my bop list for this. But if I had to pick some standouts, I Miss the Mountains is like literally one of the greatest songs in musical theater for me. If you don't know, it's right after she's like really heavily medicated after experimenting with a ton of different medications. And she's at this point where she like literally feels nothing. And she just is like a zombie going through the motions. And she sings about missing the like highs and lows of her mental illness. And that to me is like, it's honestly so relatable because like, I think that a lot of times that's something that we revert to because it feels safe. Like it's what we know. And even when we're like on medication and quote unquote, like feeling better, it also can sometimes feel like that. I'm on medication. I'm not advocating to like not take your medication for this, but I do totally understand the, like, I don't know, missing the like ups and high highs and really low lows. Yeah. I think that song is beautiful. I think that Catch Me, I'm Falling, Make Up Your Mind is such an unbelievable song. It's like literally like a therapy session where she's like going deep and for the first time with this therapist going into the trauma of her losing her son. And it's done through like a kind of, it's like a semi-hypnosis kind of technique that they do. But he like walks there, he's like holding space there with her and they're going through it together. And by the end of it, she's like finally acknowledging it. It's not like a permanent thing. Yeah. Like she definitely reverts back, but it's a huge breakthrough in that moment. And then the last one I'm going to say is Maybe. That song, yeah. I like literally sob, like ugly, ugly, ugly cry every time I see that or listen to it, honestly. And it's this moment where I think that both of them, Diana and Natalie, are the two like hero's journey people in this show.
Yeah.
And they're having this moment with each other. And Natalie, like her part of the song is her realizing that like she doesn't need, she's like, I don't need a life that's normal. Something next to normal would be okay. Yeah. It's like this moment of her being like, I don't have to be scared of being like not fitting in because I might have the same thing as my mom. I just have to figure out like how to be okay. Yeah. And in that song, Diana is like both owning up and like telling her daughter that like her leaving is what she has to do for herself to be free and to like begin the even tougher part of the like healing process for herself. And I don't know, it like brings me to tears every single time. Jennifer Damiano and Alice Ripley both give performances of a lifetime.
Yeah.
Okay. I could talk about the show again for hours.
I was just gonna say, you didn't mention, but this one always like it was like wallops me over the head. I Am the One, like always. It's right after the audience like realizes Gabe is dead. And again, just like a fucking wallop if you don't know it's coming. And just everything about it, again, just like literally like punches you in the face. Like the instrumentation, each solo, the trio at the end, like Aaron Tveit's like creeping around like a fucking like menacing snake. Like he's like, hey dad, it's me. Like that, like the way he like slides in is like so menacing.
Yeah.
But then when she lets loose after like the smallest and like was broken, like you say you hurt like me. And then when she like screams out the "you don't know" and it goes into the trio, it's just
"you don't know."
Yeah. Oh my god! Like the woman uses dynamics like no.
Yes, other. She has this way just, of like making her vibrato part of the like pain. I don't know.
Oh yeah, like yeah. Oh yeah, she milks that vibrato. She like she, but just like the way she like. The dynamics of Alice Ripley's voice, like the way she like can go from like she can make the vibrato really, really broken and hurting and then just like punch you in the face with it. Which I know I've said that a lot, but like I feel punched in the face by this musical sometimes.
I do too, in the best way.
Yeah. So Sunday in the Park with Joy-Joy would also say it doesn't have much of a bop list. And we've been talking for a really long time, so I'll try to go fast here. I'm just gonna point out again. I talked about Finishing the Hat and We Do Not Belong Together, so I will not harp on those any longer. The opening, Sunday in the Park with George. Fun opening, like, puts you right in it. You know what you're getting into. I really like it. Great opening.
Mm-hmm.
Color and Light, great song. I'm just trying to go fast. But Everybody Loves Louie is hilarious. Lots of bread jokes, like, because he needs me. I mean, like, dough, George. It's very funny. And then moving into the second act, of course you have Putting It Together, Children in Art, which is one of my favorite songs in the entire world.
Did you skip Sunday?
I didn't mean to. We talked about Sunday. Sunday, okay, good. A fucking person.
That's my favorite song.
Literally burst into tears every time it happens. I think I just like want to talk about Children in Art. It's like the highlight of the second act for me. It's just like, I mean, this isn't a hot take either, but it's just such a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous song. And then Move On, I also really like. Yeah.
We stand.
We stand. We have to stand. Oh, God. All right.
Okay. Well, maybe on our OnlyFans, we'll make a part two because we have so much to say. But for now, we should move.
So many things to say.
Yeah, honestly, we should like do some exclusive content.
We should. Move on.
Yes, like Bernadette Peters.
Oh my god. All right, so do you want to go first or should I go first? I'm really excited about mine, but I think you are too.
I'm happy to do either.
I'll go first. I'm in the dock first.
Okay.
Okay, so I was trying to think of another, and I tweeted about this the other day. All of you five people who liked it, you know it's
actually
coming.
It was 12.
Oh, thank you. Anyway, so I was just thinking of like other famous paintings that could be made into musicals. And there's just one obvious choice that I'm honestly kind of surprised hasn't been thought of. And I didn't look up if it has been, but if it has been, it hasn't come across my radar, and that's the most important thing. So we're going to make another painting musical, baby, about Las Meninas, which is by Diego Velázquez. It was painted in 1656. Ever heard of it?
I have, actually.
Yeah, it's a great painting.
It's at the Prado.
The Prado in Madrid.
Prado.
Is it in Madrid? Yes. I've seen it in person, and I got yelled at in Spanish by a security guard for taking a picture of it. And you know what he told me? I understood. I was like speaking to him in Spanish. I was actually kind of like happy he spoke to me in Spanish because that made me feel good about myself. But he told me, don't do that. You know better. I was like, do I?
Toupe. I
was like, okay, I felt really bad. Yeah.
Did you get the photo?
I do have the photo.
Yes.
I do. Okay, you know what? I'm probably never going to see it again at this rate. Like,
yeah. So.
Anyway, it's a gorgeous painting by Diego Velázquez. It was painted in 1656, and it's considered one of the most important paintings in history, and it's like one of the most analyzed pieces of art in history. So I included a picture of it so you can look at it, Logan. So the themes of this particular work of art, so it kind of focuses on like reality versus illusion, you know, what is real, what is not, and kind of moves on to art, therefore life is an illusion. If life reflects art or art reflects life. And that's kind of the larger theme in like a lot of Spanish like works from that period of time. Like, for example, Don Quixote, which I've also read in Spanish.
Did you take that class?
I did take that class. It was actually really fun. It was a class at Vanderbilt. I loved the professor. He was great. Anyway, so I think this painting is another just like overanalyzed, extremely beautiful work of art that would make a wonderful musical. So to start, I'm kind of going to go over like Velázquez a little bit and like what the painting actually is. If you haven't seen it, you can look it up while you're listening to this. So kind of to start, what this painting like really looks like. So it's a scene of the Royal Alcazar of Madrid during the reign of King Philip IV of Spain. So Velázquez was the court appointed painter basically during this time. And that was kind of, I don't know if it was like strange, but he was like very ingrained into like the royal society, and that was a little weird. So like at that time in Spain, painting, and this is all from Wikipedia, so Velázquez heads out there, I'm really interested in this, so like hit me up if you have more information. But from what I've read, at that time in Spain, like painting was considered more craft than art. So like music or poetry would have been considered like an art, but not really painting. So artists didn't necessarily have much status, even if their art was like widely received or like well received. So it was a little out of the ordinary for him to be like so ingrained in royal society and close to royal family. When he painted Las Meninas, he'd been in the royal household for about 33 years. So there's this theory that by painting this painting, he was kind of summarizing his career up until that point. So if you look at it, I'll kind of go through what it looks like. But if you look at it, it is basically his only self-portrait. And it's like he's surrounded by the finer things at court. And by showing himself in the painting, so the artist is in the painting, he's like asserting the importance of art and the artist within Spanish society. Mm-hmm. So let's get into what this painting actually looks like. So focal point is the young princess, the Infanta Margaret Teresa. So if you have never seen this painting, like you, or if you don't know much about this painting, if you see a picture of her, you probably like would be like, oh yeah, like I know that girl. Like she's like the focal point and probably the most like recognizable thing about it. And she's surrounded by her crew, like her entourage. She's got ladies in waiting. There's a dog. And then there are two court dwarves. And I looked that up just to like try to make sure that was the correct terminology. And the internet seems to think it is. But if I am wrong, please let me know. I would love to be correct at some point. So that is kind of like the focal point of the painting. And then you see an artist who is Velázquez himself painting a portrait that you can't see. So he's facing you and you can see the back of the canvas. But they're all kind of looking at you. So like the audience.
He looks kind of like Sirius Black.
A little bit. Oh, let me see. Gary Oldman vibes. So he's like looking at you and everyone is kind of looking at you, so it feels like the audience is like a part of this painting, which is also what makes it like super famous and very analyzed. And this could be an interesting point of contrast to Sunday, because apparently Sondheim said that while looking at George's painting, the only thing missing was the artist for him. And that's, like, what piqued his interest. Mm. But, of course, like, the artist is actually in this painting.
Yeah.
So, in the mirror behind Velázquez and the princess, you can see the king and the queen in the mirror. And they're standing what looks like where you would be, insinuating, like, they are the subjects of the painting. Or are they standing there? Who knows? And in the doorway, you can see his name is Don Jose Nieto Velázquez, and he is an attendant to the queen. It's unknown whether he's coming or going, but a popular theory about the painting is that he was, like, coming to get the king and queen to be like, we have to go somewhere else. And that would explain why one of the ladies in waiting is, like, mid-curtsy in the front of the painting. There's also a theory that the reflection is not actually the king and queen, but the canvas itself. So, like, maybe the king and queen aren't there at all. It's just, like, the canvas.
I'm, like, y'all, if you haven't yet, pull this painting up. I'm, like, obsessed with it now.
I'm obsessed with this painting. We learned about it in high school. And honestly, like, it's not even really, like, the story behind it is not even really that interesting. It's just, like, what the fuck is going on? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Like, but... And then,
there's
like,
just a lot to take
there's
in.
There's just like a lot going on. And it's also just like, very beautiful. But, and then to get at like the question of like, okay, why did he paint it this way? Like, why did he paint the princess? Why did he paint himself painting something else, like seemingly? And the biggest theory is that like maybe the princess was brought in while he was painting the king and queen, just like because they were bored while they were sitting there. And she's their only daughter. So they like wanted to hang out with their kid. And the king or the queen was like, oh, like, she'd be a much better, like, subject for your painting. And he was like, ah, ha, ha, and then thought of doing this whole thing. Anyway, so that's kind of the setup. We have all these different characters all around. So, the musical could be called, obviously it wouldn't be called this, but I was like, Sunday in the Park with George, Sunday in the Alcazar with Diego. that's the name of my musical. and its themes and its structure. So it would take place, I was thinking, like, over the course of Diego Velázquez making the painting, with Velázquez himself as the main character. And as he kind of paints the picture, and obviously, like, he's not painting Las Meninas in the picture Las Meninas, but in this show he would be. And as he's, like, painting the picture, these, like, different characters would pop up, like, in their respective spots. And it would kind of be, like, an exploration of the connection between illusion and reality and art, and, like, how it all takes place in his head, and how, like, he created all these, he, like, created this painting, and that's how we remember these people. Which, when you think about it, is kind of crazy that, like, this one guy made a painting of these people, and that is their, like, everlasting image.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy. Anyway.
It is.
So, the characters. We have the artist, of course, Diego Velázquez. Heard of him. Anyway. And, as I said, he would, like, have the different characters popping up as he's creating them. And then, like, what about them is real to the character? And, like, what about them is something that he created and that we only remember because, like, he made it up, or he, like, you know, put some kind of aspect on them that made us think of it. That's a lot of power. And power in the face of, like, royalty, which also is a lot of power. So it's, like, an interesting dynamic to explore, I think. And then you have the Infanta. So we could get a child prodigy actor up in here. And at this point of the painting, as I said, like, she was the only surviving child of Philip IV and Queen Mariana at this time. And she's definitely, like, the most recognizable thing about this painting, I think. Like,
I have a suggestion for who could play this.
Oh my god, I'd love to hear it.
Sydney Lucas.
How old is she?
She's like, okay, well, imagining she's still as young as she was in Fun Home, which
that's
was,
true.
I guess, in, like, 2011 or 15 or something.
Yeah, because the princess is, like, 5 years old, but obviously, like, she probably needs to be at least, like, 10.
Yeah.
she's, like, the most recognizable thing about the painting, and I thought she could have, like, obviously she's a kid, she can't, or maybe she can do some heavy lifting, who knows, but, like, be nice to give her, like, a little bit of, like, comedic relief, like, oh, like, you thought this painting was about the king and queen, like, well, they decided they should paint me instead, and, like, she's, like, the everlasting image of this, and she's, like, kind of a conceited little kid because of it.
She could be, like, the, June and Gypsy.
Yeah. Good comparison.
Stage kid.
Love it. And then you have, so, Don Jose Nieto Velázquez, who's the queen's attendant, who's back in the doorway. So, he is, like, it's debated, like, what he's doing back there, because, like, where he's standing, the people in the room except the subjects of the painting, so perhaps the king and queen, and, like, the audience wouldn't, no one would be able to see him except us, like, where he's standing. So I thought it'd be fun to, like, kind of a la Hot Up Here, the song in Sunday, where all the, like, characters are standing there, like, it's hot up here, you know, to have him just, like, really, like, having an existential crisis about what the fuck he's doing. Like, he's stuck in this door, who knows, like, he's not coming, he's not going, just, like, and that could turn in from, like, comedy to, like, something, like, more serious, you know?
Yeah.
And then you have King Philip IV and Queen Mariana. So I want them, like, stuck in the mirror in the background, like, they can't move from the mirror. And just, like, the running gag of, like, are we already on the painting? Like, are we not real, or are we sitting for the painting and are we real? Just like this, like, you know,
yeah.
Reality. What is it? And then, so two of the kind of, like, side characters are the ladies in waiting. So we've got, let me try to pronounce this correct, Doña Isabel de Velasco and Doña Maria Agustina Sarmiento de Sotomayor. So Isabel is the one who's poised to curtsy. So she's probably, like, pretty fucking tired and shaky. She's just, like, almost kneeling the whole time. She's basically doing squats for, like, an hour, which would suck. So they could be some fun comic relief. And then you have, and this is, like, I think one of the most interesting parts of the painting. So you have the two dwarves, who are Maria Barbola and Nicholas Pertusato. So they're actual people, of course, like he's painting like the court, right? And Nicholas is kind of playing with the dog, like he's like kind of kicking the dog. And I think it'd be fun to have a person dressed up as a dog and they could do like a fun, like they could have like a fun little like comedic relief thing, right?
Yeah.
And then Maria, who's the other dwarf. So she is like very, the way she's portrayed in the picture is like very dignified. Like if you look at her, she's kind of, she's off to the right side. She's like standing up very straight. She's looking the viewer directly in the eyes, which
it looks kind of like Annabelle.
A little bit.
Like, yeah. In the way that it's, like, sitting up straight and, yeah. Like, literally staring at you and
yeah.
Has, like, really pronounced features.
Yes. So she's, like, and that, unfortunately, was, like, not a very super common portrayal of, like, someone of her status back in the day, right? Like, court dwarves were, like, bought and sold by royalty. Like, they were basically slaves. Like, they didn't have, like, any, like, agency over their own lives. Like, it's a really fucked up thing. But the yeah. way she's painted is, like, very dignified, and it there's like a real a kind of like sense of respect, at least like that I can see, like coming from Velázquez to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm sensing some like amazing solo ballads in that character's future. I like some like very like you know, tales of her like her days at court, like how she feels about like how she's remembered, because I think like she's definitely like a focal point of a lot of analysis for the piece.
She's the Olive Ostrowski of the group.
Oh, of course. The best one. If I do say so myself. Yeah. And then, of course, like, there would be a lot of fourth wall breaking in this show, maybe, because the audience is a subject. Like, the audience is part of this.
They're space. In it, yeah.
Like, that's why it's so analyzed and so interesting. Yeah, I'm really surprised this doesn't exist. I think it should.
Let's change that.
Let's do it. That's my recreate, baby.
Amazing. Okay, mine. So, in Next to Normal, Arthur, we funnily went a kind of similar route.
Okay.
So, in Next to Normal, the character Natalie, she's played by our Queen of Queens, Jennifer Damiano. Yes. And in the show, she's a musician. She specifically plays piano. But since Sunday in the Park with George is an amazing show, I was like, what if she was, instead of a pianist, if she was a painter? So I thought I'd rewrite her song, Everything Else, which is how she, like, basically sings about using piano to cope with, like, wanting to fit in and not end up like her mom, to be about her love for painting instead of her classical piano music that she plays. So it's about Van Gogh instead of Mozart. So if you don't know the original, it's she goes like, Mozart was crazy, flat fucking crazy, bad shit I hear.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing is about how he was crazy, but his music is really balanced and clear. And that's how like she wants to be, is like his music and not like the crazy part of him.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Everything Else about Van Gogh. Van Gogh was crazy, flat fucking crazy, chopped off his ear. But his paintings aren't crazy. There's landscapes, there's portraits, a painting Shakespeare. There's boldness, expression in all of his strokes. You watch mournfully as emotions evoke. You look at his sky as you try to appease and you paint. And everything else goes away. Everything else goes away. And then honestly, most of the rest is pretty similar because they both fit. And you paint till it's perfect. You paint till, oh, no. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Till you ache. You paint till the brush, till your brush or your fingernails break. So you'll rock that big portrait. No chance that you'll fail. So you won't feel so sick and you won't look so pale. Because you got, she still gets a full ride in this one. You got your full ride and your early admit. So you're done with this school and with all of this shit. And you graduate early. You're gone as of May. And there's nothing your paranoid parents can say. And you know that it's just one starry night away, and you paint, and you paint, and everything else goes away.
Wow. No chance that you'll fail. Is that perchance I think
yes.
I knew it. No one knows what we're talking about right now. So we had this song of me and Logan. We were in the original cast. Shout out to Van Pelt's original cast. And there was one show that I produced, and we had this song in it, and we had to change the words. And we couldn't say, the original lyric is, you'll get into Yale.
Right? Yeah.
And we couldn't say that because the character is already in college. So we said, no chance that,
no
you'll,
chance
fail.
That you'll fail.
And you stole it. You borrowed it from me.
I borrowed it.
Wow. Beautiful. That was so good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow. That was so much fun.
It was.
I just had a blast. Wow.
Honestly, it's a long one, but like I could go even further.
Yeah,
so
I'm not
I think we
finished.
Did good given the two shows we're talking about.
I didn't even get into Mandy Patinkin's TikTok presence, so.
Yeah, there's a lot I didn't get into.
Wow.
Should we tease them next week's
we
theme?
We should. Do you have it?
Okay, I do have it.
Okay, I'll drum roll for you. Ready?
Yes.
Next week's theme is.
Questionable that these shows made this list. So the context on this one is like when Sammy and I were planning out the show, we like chose these shows like one at a time, kind of like we were drafting a football, like an online football thing. And for one of them, I was like, we should both just choose something like really out of left field that we want to talk about, but that we don't necessarily like love or think it's the best thing ever. So that's what next week's going to be, is something that is maybe a little questionable that we're even talking about it, but
wow.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have like 3 beers instead of 2 during that. Oh man, it's going to be fun. It's going to be
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it is.
Oh god.
Okay, well we'll see you next week. We'll and by that, I mean you'll hear us next week.
Yeah, we won't see you.
But we love you.
Love you. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Yay! That was so much fun.
Rated.